You are listening to a free podcast of The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. To support the show and receive nearly an hour extra material daily, become a member today at majority.fm. Resistance is futile.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see?
I keep referring to Obama as the magic Negro.
Do you like what you see now?
Well, suck on this.
It's just a mirror, America.
Shared sacrifice by everybody.
What could it do to you except reflect your image?
I did nothing wrong at the Minneapolis airport.
The Majority Report.
Far more credible to me than PBS
and Frontline.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
And I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Tuesday, October 29th, 2013. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Today on the program, legal affairs editor from the New Republic and professor of law at George Washington University, Jeffrey Rosen, will be here to talk to us about the ongoing revelations of NSA spying here, abroad, foreign leaders, of maybe your neighbor, maybe you. Also on the program today, Pakistani victims of drone strikes testifying in front of a congressional hearing today set up by Representative Grayson. Also on the program today, food stamps set to be cut. That anti-abortion law that was the focus of the Texas state filibuster by Wendy Davis, struck down by a federal judge. Also, Harry Reid to introduce ENDA in front of the Senate, and Marco Rubio, true to form, renounces his own immigration bill. And finally, Suzanne Summers. Yes, that's Suzanne Summers. Has come out against Obamacare because it's a socialist Ponzi scheme. This is going to be shocking, but Suzanne Summers is wrong. Obamacare is not a socialist Ponzi scheme. Let's just go into this briefly, this Suzanne Summers story, because it's worth... I actually saw this in the Wall Street Journal yesterday. It was posted around 11:30, and I thought it was a joke. I thought it was like one of those onion pieces, but no. Suzanne Summers, not even the brightest one from Three's Company, has come out with a piece in the Wall Street Journal saying that as a writer of 24 books, mostly on health and wellness, and by using my celebrity to get the best and brightest doctors, scientists, and medical professionals in the alternative and integrative healthcare world, I have come to the following conclusions. First of all, let's call affordable healthcare what it really is. It's socialized medicine. First off, she should probably also meet with people who can teach her to write properly. But we can stop right there. The Affordable Health Care Act is not even socialized health insurance. It is a neoliberal market-based solution or near solution to the problem of a failed health insurance industry and a system that provides distorted subsidies for wealthy people. Socialized medicine would be something more akin to what we have with the VA system, where we actually have government doctors and government nurses at government-owned and run facilities providing health care. We have socialized health insurance. It's called Medicare for people over the age of 65, and Medicaid for people who live in poverty or at 133% above poverty if that state has adopted the Affordable Care Act expansion of Medicaid. We could stop right there and say that Suzanne Summers is an idiot. But, and then she tells a couple of anecdotes about seeing a magazine cover in Canada 3 or 4 years ago. But we should go just directly to the corrections on that the Wall Street Journal had to post for its opinion piece that they let Suzanne Summers author in their pages. An earlier version of this post contained a quotation attributed to Lenin. So, quote, socialized medicine is the keystone to the arc of the socialist state. That has been widely disputed. So they just took the whole quote out. Maybe that's why her piece reads so disjointedly. And it included a quotation attributed to Churchill, quote, control your citizens' health care and you control your citizens. That the journal has been unable to confirm. So she made up a couple of quotes to talk about something that she was completely wrong about. And she's talking about how the baby boomers are going to get screwed by the Affordable Care Act. The baby boomers are going to head into Medicare. I thought this was a joke. It wasn't. I had to address it. And also the final correction from the Wall Street Journal. Also, the cover of a Maclean's magazine issue in 2008. This is the Canadian magazine cover she referenced. Showed a picture of a dog on an examining table with the headline, "Your dog can get better health care than you." An earlier version of this post incorrectly said the photo showed a and headline referred to a horse. So there is Suzanne Summers' deep dive into health insurance.
Why can't we all just be right wing? It would just be so much easier.
So much easier. We got to take a break. We'll be right back with Jeffrey Rosen. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report. It's a pleasure to welcome to the program the president of the National Constitution Center, the legal affairs editor at the New Republic, and a professor of law at George Washington University, Jeffrey Rosen. Thanks for joining us, Jeffrey.
Pleasure to be here.
So let's work backwards, I guess, from the revelations that we have received and continue to receive from the Edward Snowden leaks of and all that they have brought about. The latest being that we now know that 35 at least 35 heads of state, as well as literally tens of millions of Spaniards, French, perhaps Germans. I mean, we don't. I mean, it seems it could be just endless. And I just wanted to get your reaction, particularly. I know you've written a piece on PRISM. Tell us what the PRISM program is and how it seems to be impacting nationals, not just from this country, but from at least France, and now it appears Spain.
Well, the PRISM program, as we know from the latest revelations, involves the mass collection not only of metadata, that is the duration and time of telephone calls, but the actual content of telephone calls and text messages of, as you said, millions or tens of millions of non-American citizens abroad. 70 million French people appear to have had their telephone conversations recorded or listened in on. And Europe is in an uproar about this. But the fascinating legal bottom line is that much of this is very difficult for Europeans to challenge in U.S. courts, for the simple fact that the U.S. Supreme Court has held that the Fourth Amendment to the Constitution, which protects American citizens against unreasonable searches and seizures, does not apply to foreigners abroad. Basically, the U.S. Constitution does not constrain the NSA when it's targeting non-citizens, and foreign intelligence surveillance law further draws a really sharp line between citizens and non-citizens. So the NSA is essentially unconstrained, according to American constitutional and statutory restrictions, about the kind of spying it can do abroad, and this has gotten Europe very, very upset indeed.
I mean, what's fascinating about this, too, is that it seems to the revelations of spying on foreign leaders and on just millions of ordinary citizens, unless there's something really just bizarre going on in France and Spain, it seems to be getting sort of prompting more outrage by many of our Dianne Feinstein came out, for example, yesterday and said this was very problematic. I'm not sure that she was terribly sincere about it, but largely these are questions more of politics and foreign relations than they are legal issues within this country.
That's right. To the degree that it's very hard for non-citizens to get into U.S. courts to challenge this, you're right that it will require a political solution. The European Parliament or the Council of Europe or basically individual European leaders like Angela Merkel of Germany, the Prime Minister, calling up President Obama and saying, stop listening in on my telephone calls, for there to be some kind of real response.
And I want to tack to the pieces you've written about some FISA court documents that have been released. But do you think that the the review, the idea that it seems clear, at least from the level of spying that the NSA is engaged in terms of foreign leaders, particularly allied foreign leaders and regular individuals of allies, is going to have implications on the legal arguments in this country, or at least in terms of what the statutory response may be by Congress, just insofar as it undercuts a key, I guess, talking point that what the NSA is doing is fundamentally designed to protect American citizens?
I think it might. The argument previously had been, don't worry, first of all, the NSA is only looking at metadata, it's not listening in on the content of conversations, and also it's only looking at individuals when they've been identified as suspected spies or terrorists. But these latest revelations show that that's not at all the case, that the content of the phone calls not of suspected terrorists, but of our closest allies, are actually being recorded and listened in on. I think that really is a game changer. It will make it harder for those in Congress to say that the NSA should have carte blanche to listen in on non-citizens abroad. And it will shore up the legal case of those who are challenging in U.S. courts, not only the prison program, but the metadata telephone spying program, who argue with some force that mass surveillance without a warrant of millions of individual data subjects is a quintessential violation of the Fourth Amendment. It's exactly what the framers of the Fourth Amendment tried to avoid when they wanted to prohibit general warrants without particularized suspicion. And it might lead some pressure on U.S. courts and even ultimately the Supreme Court to reexamine the idea that when you turn over data to a third party like the telephone company for one purpose, you abandon all expectations of privacy in it for all other purposes. That was the decision. It was called Smith versus Maryland from 1979 that the FISA court relied on in upholding the metadata program. And I think these latest revelations are just going to make it harder and harder to sustain those kinds of arguments.
I want to get into Smith v. Maryland in a second. And I guess what I'm also saying is that I wonder how much in the calculations of federal courts and of in terms of like what is the way that these things have been interpreted, if this specter of sort of the U.S. government's interest in keeping Americans safe is in any way undercut by what these revelations show is the NSA agenda, at least abroad. Because it's clear from these revelations that this isn't just about terrorism. This is about economic advantage. This is about maybe some broader geopolitical issues that aren't so clear-cut about this extraordinary threat of terrorism that we have been told justifies this.
I think it could change the conversation. As you say, I think Congress and the American people are only willing to tolerate mass surveillance when they're convinced that only individuals who are really bad guys and related to terrorism are actually having their data seized. But when the surveillance is used for these broad other purposes that sweep up not just scores, but millions and millions of phone calls and text messages, it's just harder to say with a straight face that this is mostly about terrorism.
All right, so let's turn to the this argument about Smith v. Maryland, because this case, and particularly when the revelations of the metadata first came about, we kept hearing Smith v. Maryland cited as this is settled law. It's assuming the NSA is only collecting metadata as opposed to. In which we sort of subsequently learned, in some respects, they seem to be creating sort of almost a reference library of recorded calls. But talk to us about why Smith v. Maryland really does not speak to what we are seeing now, and does not acknowledge later cases that may undercut it. And I'm talking specifically the opinion that was released by the FISA court about, I guess, a month or so ago.
Exactly. As you say, the Smith v. Maryland was the core of this FISA court's previously secret opinion. And the FISA court said, the Supreme Court found in Smith v. Maryland, that once a person has transmitted telephone metadata to a third party, in this case, a telephone company, the person has no legitimate expectation of privacy in the information. But the FISA court acknowledged there's an obvious distinction between Smith and the mass surveillance we're talking about now. In Smith, the government was getting a few dialed telephone numbers of one person who was actually suspected of a crime. This is very different. Here, the government's getting millions of telephone numbers of millions of people suspected of no crime. So you'd say that Smith doesn't apply at all. But the FISA court dismisses this distinction by citing one of its own secret opinions for the proposition that when one individual does not have a Fourth Amendment interest, grouping together a large number of similarly situated individuals cannot result in a Fourth Amendment interest springing into existence ex nihilo. And that's the core of the analysis, and, you know, we can talk about whether or not that's persuasive, but that's it's certainly stretching the facts to take a case that was decided where there was suspicion of one particular individual to justify mass surveillance of innocent individuals.
For those of us who just went to law school for a year, ex nihilo.
I think it means from nowhere, out of nowhere, okay. Although my high school Latin is not as good as it used to be.
Okay, well, so break this down for me. When one individual does not have a Fourth Amendment interest, in other words, when a guy who goes to a payphone and starts to dial a bunch of numbers and knows that they are that person is using the payphone that's provided by Verizon or whoever it is at the time, Ma Bell, and is giving that information that they're calling a certain number, when they willingly give that to the phone company by using their phone, they don't have a Fourth Amendment interest. How is it that everyone else who is sucked up in this metadata is similarly situated? Is it just simply because they're using a phone? Is that the idea?
Well, you put it very well, and basically the FISA court is saying, as you were trying to reconstruct the argument, if one individual doesn't have any protections of privacy when that person makes one phone call, then millions of people don't have a privacy interest in the aggregate. But there are a lot of responses to that argument. First of all, the guy in Smith was suspected of a crime. It may not have risen to the level of probable cause, but it wasn't suspicionless hoovering up of his information. So it's not clear that you have, even that one individual has no interest in the metadata. But the second and more powerful distinction is, when you hoover up millions of phone calls, that can reveal so much more about people in the aggregate, patterns of associations, political protests. The Supreme Court in the Jones GPS case, which the FISA court doesn't cite, said that an individual does have an expectation of privacy when his movements are surveilled for an entire month, because that month-long surveillance can reveal so many millions of individual interactions. And I think you could certainly argue that the hoovering up and surveillance of millions of individual phone metadata records similarly can reveal so much about people in the aggregate that we do have expectations of privacy in that kind of information.
And you also mention in your piece in the New Republic that there's also the judge in this case, the FISA court judge, Judge Egan, seems to gloss over or literally just drop the notion of relevant to an authorized investigation. In other words, it seems that the FISA court has really taken the words investigation and made it very malleable.
That's exactly right. As you say, there are two legal challenges to this metadata program, the constitutional challenge we've just discussed, but then separately, groups like the Electronic Privacy Information Center are saying this program was not justified by Section 215 of the Patriot Act. Section 215 of the Patriot Act, it's important to quote the language precisely as you did, it says that any valid order has to include, quote, a statement of facts showing that there are reasonable grounds to believe that the tangible things sought are relevant to an authorized investigation, end quote. But the judge in his FISA opinion incredibly omitted the last words of that statutory language, to an authorized investigation, and rewrote the legal requirement to say this, the government can meet the standard if it can demonstrate reasonable grounds to believe the information sought to produce has some bearing on its investigations of the identified international terrorism organizations. So in other words, she converted the statutory requirement that the data are relevant to an authorized investigation that already exists and converted that into saying that as long as the information might have some bearing on some future series of investigations, plural, it can be sought. And that really seems to eliminate the particularity requirement that even Representative Sensenbrenner, who wrote Section 215, said that he thought was implicit in the statute. That's why he and others have criticized the administration's reading of Section 215 and why the judge really seemed to have converted a requirement of relevance to a particular existing investigation into a carte blanche for hoovering up anything that might theoretically be relevant to a series of future investigations in the plural.
And this is, this is at least one of the things that Senators Wyden and Udall were basically sort of saying but not saying over and over again, that the FISA court was interpreting this in a very broad manner. I mean, the court seems to be sort of almost like dropping the idea of a noun here, an investigation, and just sort of saying, and almost changing it into a verb, as in when you're investigating things.
You're absolutely right. I mean, I feel like a grammarian here, but Jim Harper from the Cato Institute has a really powerful brief in one of the cases challenging Section 215 under this reading, and he makes a similar point that really the grammar is important here, and singular versus plural is important, and it's basically the difference between particularized suspicion of an actual identifiable individual in connection with a particular investigation and just the thought that, hey, maybe this stuff might be useful in the future so we can get anything we like and we'll tell you what's relevant later.
Now, I mean, let's sort of just broaden out here. The FISA court was pressured, essentially, because of all of the controversy here, to begin to release their opinions. Let's just start with the idea of, was the FISA court conceived with the idea that they would be making opinions on law as opposed to fact? I mean, I think this is one of the things that at least struck me with these revelations, is that what was sort of like a set up as a sort of a magistrate, as something that was supposed to look at the validity of bench warrants in some way, began to interpret law in a way that we perceive happens within a different legal structure almost.
I think you're right that the function seems to have vastly expanded beyond what the framers of the court expected. The FISA court was created in 1978. It came after Frank Church, who ran something called the Church Committee, which was investigating government abuse and the assassination of foreign leaders and domestic spying. He worried that new technologies could, quote, make tyranny total in America. So after the Church Commission, Democrats wanted the NSA to get warrants for surveillance in regular federal courts. Republicans didn't want many restrictions on surveillance at all. And the compromise of the FISA court was, we'll have a secret court. It won't hear both sides of the argument. It'll only hear the government side. It won't issue opinions, but at least it will make a determination about whether or not the evidence sought is relevant to a terrorism investigation and whether the particular individual sought to be surveilled is a suspected spy or terrorist. That was the crucial requirement. And it was that requirement that was eliminated in the Patriot Act. You no longer had to prove that the individual being surveilled was a suspected spy or terrorist, but instead that, as we've been discussing, the evidence was just relevant to an investigation. And then the FISA court recently seems to have broadened things further by changing the language in the way we've been discussing, and also imposing its own sort of statutory fixes. There was fear that if the government could really get everything without any limits, then that would be a general warrant. But in another secret opinion, the FISA court on its own seemed to have required that some government agent certify that the information was relevant to terrorism before an individual could be identified. So basically, the court is rewriting the statute, making up requirements on its own in order to save the constitutionality of it. And that does seem very different than the function that it was set up to prove, which is basically reviewing to see whether or not a particular individual was dangerous enough to be surveilled without a warrant.
I mean, by what authority do they do that? I mean, it just seems strange that there is really no higher court that one could take these things to, right? I mean, perhaps now we're starting to see that, but were there not leaks, but for the leaks, we would not necessarily know that there's these secret opinions out there, or at least we wouldn't be able to know what was in them, and they couldn't be challenged. And it almost seems like, I mean, by what authority does the FISA court issue these opinions? And is there anyone who is there any standing to challenge the authority of the FISA court to release these opinions, or do I just not get how this works?
I think you're getting it pretty well. I think the way that it was set up, the FISA court has huge discretion on its own to release opinions or not on its own time and within its own discretion. It's theoretically possible to appeal to the U.S. Supreme Court, and in fact, Justice Antonin Scalia said not so long ago that he expects eventually a version of these surveillance programs to go up to court. But the way the statute is constructed, it's not easy to get an appeal from the FISA court to the U.S. Supreme Court for technical reasons. So really, the most important fix will come in Congress, and there is some useful debate in Congress right now about the need to have more transparency of the FISA court, to make its opinions public, to ensure that both sides are presented, to change the appointment procedure, which right now means that the Chief Justice appoints all of the FISA judges. And, you know, there are critics who have themselves served on the FISA court. Judge Robertson resigned from the FISA court because he was so upset about the unfairness of the procedure. So I think Congress is beginning to take notice, and ultimately reform will have to come from Congress.
And as far as I know, there are now two bills, I guess, sort of making their way through the Senate and the House. I guess these don't necessarily directly speak to the reformation of the FISA court, but at the very least, there's one which would simply end the mass collection of phone data, and another which would massage the collection of phone data, I guess. I mean, there was one other aspect of this I wanted to also get your thoughts on. Very recently, there has been a shift where the Justice Department is going to notify criminal defendants that that evidence that is presented against them may have come from a warrantless wiretap. Do you know much about this? What can you tell us, and what are the implications of this?
Well, we know it was an important policy shift. There was a big debate within the Obama administration, and Solicitor General Donald Verrilli argued strongly and ultimately successfully that criminal defendants did have to be notified about this secret evidence. It could be significant. It could make it easier for a criminal defendant who prosecuted on the basis of evidence for which he was initially not notified to get into court. It's not clear whether by getting into court the defendant would be challenging the failure of prior notification, which would be a narrow challenge, or whether once in court that defendant would have the ability to raise a broader constitutional challenge to the entire surveillance program. Remember, last February, the U.S. Supreme Court rejected an attempt to challenge the constitutionality of the program on the grounds that the people who claimed that they feared that they'd been spied on couldn't prove that they'd been spied on and therefore had no standing to come into federal court. It was a kind of Alice in Wonderland argument. But now, first of all, the government has acknowledged the scope of the program, namely all telephone calls being hoovered up, and also confessed error about this failure to notify defendants previously. It'll be easier to get into court, but as I say, it's not a slam dunk, and it turns on a series of technicalities that may ultimately defeat an effort to challenge the constitutionality of the program squarely.
Are there specific cases? I mean, I know that I think the EFF has been involved in this. I imagine the Constitution Center has been as well. But are there a couple of cases that you are watching that had been denied standing in the past, but because of these revelations now are going forward? I mean, which cases do you think may end up at the Supreme Court, and which are the most important in terms of having some type of legal implications on what the NSA is doing and the sort of the infrastructure that allows for it?
I'll answer that in a second. I should just clarify that the National Constitution Center, which I had, we don't file lawsuits. On the contrary, we have a mandate from Congress to disseminate information on the U.S. Constitution on a nonpartisan basis. So we present all sides of all constitutional arguments. And in talking with you today, I'm trying to give a sense of the arguments on both sides while making it also clear what I think. But there are lawsuits filed by organizations like EFF. I think the one that's most likely to get a jump here is filed by the Electronic Privacy Information Center. They have challenged the metadata program on the grounds that it violates Section 215 of the Patriot Act, and I think that they may well get a little bit further in court now because of this policy change. Also, the defendant who has been notified that his own phone calls were being introduced against him will now have an opportunity to challenge that failure of prior notification. We don't know who that is, I think, but the government said that there's at least one terrorist suspect who's now been notified because of the new policy shift, and he or she may be able to file a legal challenge as a result of that policy shift.
The and aside from the sort of the FISA amendments that we're talking about, Section 215, the Patriot Act, there's also sort of controversy around, I think it's Section 702, is it?
Exactly.
702. Of the FISA amended. Are there any cases that are going to be sort of turning on that?
Those are trickier. 702 is the one that's responsible for all this spying abroad. And 702 is after it was revealed during the Bush administration that the NSA was spying on lots of foreign citizens without a warrant. And indeed, Alberto Gonzalez rushed to the hospital bed of John Ashcroft, who refused to authorize this program called, I think it was called Stellar Wind.
Stellar Wind, which, yes.
Yeah, exactly. Which was based on Section 702. Ashcroft refuses to sign off. Eventually, the White House continues the internet and telephone eavesdropping program anyway under 702. The Obama NSA shuts down the metadata surveillance program, says it can't be authorized, continues to collect metadata under the USA Patriot Act. But basically, Congress comes in and amends Section 702 in a way that justifies and expands the surveillance of foreigners abroad. And that is a very important provision. It's been construed by the FISA court in a way that has added a few legal protections. But the bottom line here, for the reasons we began by talking about, to the degree that it's foreigners who are being spied on under Section 702, they're going to find it really tough to get into court. So it may be harder to find a court case to challenge 702.
And so that's something that we're going to see, that there's going to have to be a political response if there is one. And that's just going to be a function, I guess, of the domestic politics of those countries whose citizens have been spied upon.
It's true, but the politics are tough, aren't they? Because there is a bipartisan coalition in America that doesn't like government spying on citizens, and that includes civil libertarian liberals like Senator Wyden and libertarian conservatives like Rand Paul or Representative Sensenbrenner, perhaps. I think there might be some political will to rein in domestic spying on innocent citizens, but at least the libertarian conservative wing is less concerned about the privacy of foreigners. So therefore, I think it's really going to be diplomacy between the European leaders, the European Parliament, and President Obama, and Obama and the State Department will have to be convinced that U.S. foreign policy interests are really significantly harmed by this warrantless spying.
Indeed. Well, Jeffrey Rosen, president of the Constitution Center and professor of law at George Washington University, thanks so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. It was a pleasure to talk.
All right, folks. Just a reminder, it is October 29th. We are 2 days away from Halloween night. My daughter is going as Hermione Granger, one of the characters from Harry Potter. My wife and my seven-month-old son are going as her owls, because they have owls in that. I wanted to go as what is known as a muggle, but... I was not, Myla did not appreciate that, and so I am instead going as a clown who has really bad teeth because he thinks he's an owl, which is a combination of a sort of soft big red nose that I had and a set of false teeth and an extra owl headgear. So that's what I'm going as.
I like the muggle idea. That's
yeah, the muggle idea was much better.
I'm a muggle who really cares about Social Security.
That's right.
Yeah, there you go.
But not only are we 2 days away from Halloween, we are 2 days away from the end of our Credo promotion. CredoMobile.com/Sam. You get up to $350 credit on your Credo bill based upon the cost of your switchover from your present carrier. You get 25% off of data for 2 years, and you get unlimited data. You know about Credo. We're going to be talking to Becky Bond on the program tomorrow, probably more about the just the zombie quality of the administration's desire to cut social insurance programs and other issues. But Becky is the head of Credo Action, which is supported by the revenue that comes from Credo Mobile. So check it out. You got two more days. You can go to majority.fm and click through the links, or you can go to credomobile.com/Sam. You can also support this program by becoming a member at majority.fm. We need your memberships. We have attrition. Some people running into economic and financial situations. So if you enjoy this program and you got the extra 35 cents a day, why not support it? Even if you don't listen to it every day, still worth it. Then it's 70 cents if you listen to it twice a week. It's like a luxury. It's like a, yeah, it's like a luxury. Coming up in the better half, the
more fun half.
The more fun half. We will talk about these cuts to food stamps.
You know, I was going to make a joke, but I knew I didn't even need to do it. It would just happen naturally.
The anti-abortion law was struck down in Texas. That's fun. I did my fun story. That was the Suzanne Summers. I did that up front.
That was very fun.
We should invite her to come on the program.
We should.
Hello,
Enda's going to be introduced into the Senate. That's good news. Could be fun too if you want to keep your job and still be able not have to sort of hide who you are from your a-hole coworkers or a-hole boss. That's always fun. All right. Well, we'll also take your phone calls. That's always fun. At 646-257-3920, 646-257-3920. The IM machine is working. And see you in the better half. I got to come up with more fun stories to pitch in the
fun banter.
Fun banter.
Always on
horrible
tap.
Things.
Always on tap. About very terrible things.
Yeah, we will talk more about the Obamacare stories that are out there. I have a correction to make on the extra capital gains tax that's involved with Obamacare, which is actually fun in my mind. With all due respect to the guy whose folks or in-laws sold their house and made $3 million. The extra 3.8% tax on there, I just don't feel that bad about it. I really don't. And that's because I'm a communist who doesn't like to have fun. As we're having a Three's Company DVD burning after this. All right, folks. See you in the better half.